Now, it's time for Modern Money Donuts with Stephen Hale and Gabrielle Bond.
Welcome to the third episode of Series 3 of Modern Money Donuts, which is presented from Adelaide, South Australia, by Modern Money Lab on the land of the Kaurna people. And we pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and we recognise that this land was never ceded. I'm here with my colleague, Gabrielle Bond, who is going to introduce our guest today, Susan Bourton. Over to you, Gabby.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks very much. I'm going to bring in a student on our graduate courses in the economics of sustainability. Today we're talking to Susan Bourton, who has had an incredibly interesting and varied career. And she's waiting in the backstage area. So I'm going to bring her in right now. Here we go. Hi, Susan. Welcome. And welcome to our Modern Money Donuts podcast. And you're joining us from Vermont.
I am.
Excellent. In the middle of winter.
Very.
Yeah.
But No, we've had incredibly cold weather, actually. Minus 25, minus 30 Celsius.
Wow. Yeah. I've seen people chatting about that online. It does look very cold.
It's going to be plus 36 here tomorrow, so there'll be quite a gap.
On my way.
Yeah. So for those listening, Susan is very involved as a student on our courses, especially in some of the discussions that we've been having during the summer break for us, winter break for the rest of the world. And we have been talking a lot about framing. In fact, we've been catching up once a week to have a kind of common room discussion about issues around framing and language, which has been really fascinating. And I think Susan brings such a wealth of experience and knowledge to this through her really interesting and varied background. And one of the things I'd like to start our conversation off about is your involvement with neuroscience and a neuroscience institute, I believe. So, but not only neuroscience, you've been involved in, well, definitely politics, economics, obviously, and, you know, you've been involved in energy and education, and you're a trustee on Bennington College Board, and all of these things kind of knit together in really interesting and brilliant ways. And so thank you so much, Susan, for sharing your expertise with us.
Well,
can we go back to neuroscience?
We could, although I'd like to say first that it's so nice to have Stephanie Kelton's voice as our introducer, because she's really how I got to you, actually.
Stephanie's a great friend.
Well, I know that she guest lectured in Adelaide, and she knows you so well, and she was deeply enthusiastic about this, and it's why I heard anything about it at all. I wasn't at all sure that I was qualified, but I was absolutely sure that this was an almost seamless continuation of the things that I've been thinking about for, I won't say how many decades, but several. So it was just terrific.
You've been terrific, Susan, and particularly if I can say it's been great having you on both the seminar sessions, because we run them twice a day to give everybody a chance to come, and it's been absolutely fantastic. You're not the only person that's come twice a day very frequently, but it's been wonderful to have you there. You've been you've such a positive influence on what we've been doing. It's so encouraging.
Well, it's beautifully managed, beautifully run. The technology is excellent, and I can't say enough about, I don't know who to credit, maybe Gabby, for making it so smooth. But it's been absolutely, really the best intellectual experience I've had in a very, very long time. And I've had a few, so it's great.
Wow, thank you so much. That's really touching. I like to be organized. I didn't know organizing was a career until I'd already had a career as a music teacher. And then I sort of found this out by accident. But I absolutely love doing it. And I'm a little bit in same as you. I can't get enough. I love coming to the sessions. I love talking to people. I love, you know, when people go down rabbit holes, I love to follow them and hear what they're discovering, and it's just brilliant.
Well, Gabby mentioned the Neuroscience Institute, mm-hmm. but I know you also, and this is linked, you two have been part of a student discussion group on what is very early Thursday morning in Adelaide time each week on framing. But it's almost like being in a sweet shop having you here, Susan, because I also at some point want to ask you about your link to Carl Polanyi and the work of Carl Polanyi as well. But maybe I'll just back out of the conversation for the moment and you can pursue with Gabby the framing
issue. All right, let me say just a couple of things, because everything you're saying links to so much of why I'm here and what I think about and what you enable that, really. I had an unbelievably lucky university experience, which is very important to me. Mm. Lots of choices, but that made me able to attend a very, very progressive and well-established liberal arts college in the States, which is, for me, was differentiated itself because it requires each student to create and defend and revise an individual program. And it's a small place. We used to say, you know, that 700 students and 700 majors was kind of the way.
Wow.
Including 2 months of field work each year, with an expectation that we would each create new work. That was the idea. Not just in terms of subjects, but also in terms of, this was inevitably multidisciplinary for all of us. But not just in multiple subjects, but as important, maybe more important, in terms of learning modalities and aptitudes and capacities, and discovering that you could transfer those from one sort of subject domain to another. And that has stood me in unbelievably good stead because, you know, you're kind of always ready for something. And these are, sometimes these are things we have names for, and sometimes they're really not. Resilience, you know, improvisation, that sort of thing. And it doesn't surprise me at all, Gabby, as a musician, that you're a you're a conductor, you're a composer, you're, you know, those are real things. Anyway, the two things that have always intrigued me from, I mean, really always, were I guess, one is how this thing works, this brain power. I mean, it is incredible that a 3-pound
blob of goo,
could produce economies and governments and poetry and symphonies. I mean, it's really unbelievable. Yeah. And I have been riveted by this for a very long time. And for a very long time, it wasn't very the questions were stimulating, the answers were horrible, were uninteresting. It's surely wrong.
Yeah.
As wrong as they are in I think, as they are conventional economics today. You know, we thought that, well, the best in the, speaking of framing and metaphors, the big framing of neuroscience in the 70s was people thought that they were kind of like computers.
Yes.
This was hardware, there was some sort of software, and that the real job of the human brain or any animal brain was to sort of decode the environment somehow. But anybody who's been around little children knows, I'm the eldest of five, very compact family. You know, the world is not a labeled place. It's not there to be decoded. It's there actually to be created and imagined. Loved thinking about how that could possibly be, because we know everything that's, you know, we don't know how it works, but we know that we know everything about what it is, what it's made up of. So this stayed with me for a long time, and it was another thing I really couldn't study. I made more progress on the economics front because I lucked into this. I'll come back to the neuro thing in a minute, but I lucked into a situation in which my teacher at Bennington in economics had been a student and then a colleague of this fellow named Carl Polanyi. Polanyi was a political, I'd call him a political economist probably, who was born in Vienna and came to the United States as a refugee really from the war and ended up at my uni. And while he was there, he wrote a book called The Great Transformation.
Yeah, a very famous book, yeah.
Really interesting and important book. And we might talk about it or not, but the important thing was that my teacher, Harry Pearson, Polanyi had died the year before I started college, so I never knew him. But everything I learned about economics came through this very interesting lens. It had to do, honestly, with several things. One is that like minds and brains and bodies, you know, the mind is really embedded in the brain is embedded in the body is embedded in the environment. Mm. And it's how all that works together that matters. And Polanyi made an interesting, to me, parallel kind of observation, which was that we had it all screwed up in our laissez-faire market economies and that what we were doing was actually embedding critical social and political institutions in the economy, in the market, instead of embedding markets into our social and political institutions. Yeah. This made enormous sense to me.
Mm. We've been having those discussions over and over again in politics and the ins and outs of, like, I was at a workshop the other day, which just kind of illustrates this, where a bunch of academics who are concerned about the role of arts and culture in our community and making us fully human are having to fight with this kind of drive to commercialize and make money off and, you know, farm everything out to philanthropy when it comes to having art as part of everyone's lives. And so it's a discussion that won't... won't quit.
Definitely won't. Yeah. It's tough when you live in a system in which the only way you value anything is via price.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's tough.
Yeah.
Very tough. Anyway, so there I was, and I had these wonderful field work terms. I'm working for a very well-known cognitive psychologist named Jerome Bruner, which kept my brain learning inquiry going. It was terrific. And I had a project. We all had big projects, and my project, which never was completed actually, was that I wanted to create an input-output analysis of what I called, of waste, actually, of effluent. I wanted to measure there was an industrial classification system that a very fascinating fellow named Leontief had developed. And I wanted to use that structure to see if we could measure all the stuff that we were throwing away or polluting with, because I was pretty sure that was growing faster than GDP. Mm. And I thought that would be an important thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only problem was that we didn't have personal computers in those days. And so I had these index cards, they were called McBee cards, that had little holes all around the edges. And 88 or 120, I think, depending on the size of the card. And I don't know how my roommate ever lived with me, honestly, because piles of cards. And you would create categories, and then you'd notch these cards. And then I had a two-edged knitting needle that you put them through the holes, and then the ones that you wanted would drop out and so forth. It was unbelievably complicated.
It wasn't much more advanced than that in about 1980-81. When I was at college, yes, and you'd make the hole in the wrong place and then nothing
That's
would
right.
work.
Yeah. Anyway, but again, I was at an institution that welcomed that, you know, and if I failed, I'd learned everything, kind of, you know, it wasn't that so much. So I still think it's a pretty good idea, by the way, but, you know, come back to that maybe another time. So I then was involved. I'm not sure why I'm giving you my biography, really, but I actually never finished.
No, please don't stop. It's really fascinating.
You've got a fascinating biography, Susan.
That's so fine.
Please do. There's lots that you haven't said that's fascinating.
I was also deeply interested in politics. And one of the things about being in this little state of Vermont where I was a student is that, honestly, if you just show up, you know, that's you're in. I mean, you're not in, but you're counted. You matters. And at that time, we had this was during the time of the Vietnam War, civil rights movement. It was an extremely active time. My school was so progressive that there were no, it would be unthinkable to have a demonstration or something like that at school because everybody was already with the program. And I lucked into a very odd situation, which was I was invited to be the kind of token student to go speak to Robert Kennedy about running for the presidency in October, it was, of 67. And it was fascinating for me. He didn't want to do it for very good reasons. He was now a senator from New York. He had had his difficulties with the president, Lyndon Johnson, and didn't really want to relitigate those. And it was assumed that Johnson was going to run for re-election and so forth. So the next stop was Eugene McCarthy, who was a senator from Minnesota, poet, really. And he, of course, would do it.
Yeah, so, I wonder what I read that and I wondered what he was like. Can you tell us a bit about him?
He was dreamy in a way. He was incredibly philosophical and thoughtful. Kind of an anti-hero, really, in a way, politically. But he was a believer and he very much believed in young people. And he felt that this was, that we needed a voice, honestly. And that, and to everybody's shock, we have this absurd presidential selection system in the United States. And but the first primary, as they call it, that was held was in this little state of New Hampshire next door. Everybody thinks Johnson lost. He didn't actually, but he almost lost. We almost won. And he decided then to not run again, at which point Bobby came back into the race. And then I felt some loyalty to, I was for either one of them, but I felt some real loyalty to McCarthy because he'd come through when we needed him. And that was really I wasn't old enough to vote then, but I did go to Chicago, a very famous presidential convention in Chicago, which was quite violent. My first ever encounter with that sort of thing. And that was an important experience because I was a big believer in the system, whatever, in, you know, democratic institutions. And I thought, you know, the economy could be made to work better and all that sort of thing. I was very, and a lot of my friends thought I was a little, you know, that I ought to get out of this. I ought to be a little more radical.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And did it radicalize you?
I like this idea, by the way, about the radical center. It's a very good idea, I think. But it did, it affected me in certain ways and not in others. I mean, I stayed very involved in politics. I went to the 72 presidential convention. I was co-chairman of the party platform committee, which was a big deal for me, and stayed deeply engaged in trying to reform how campaigns are financed, unsuccessfully, of course, but in the United States, and I stay committed very much to that. Helped found the National Women's Education Fund, which was part of the National Women's Political Caucus to get more women engaged, which we thought was important. We have a different organization called Common Cause. I know you have one in Australia. We have one in the United States that was started in 1970. And I eventually became vice chairman of that. And that was all great. But my remit there in the end, in the mid to late 70s, really revolved around energy policy because we're in the middle of energy crises. And the question was, what should this organization, which had hundreds of thousands of members, do about that? Even though we're mostly involved in campaign finance and the Nixon situation, all that. That was great because, you can't help if you're any observer of the economy as an institution understands that energy is sort of the story, actually. I mean, it's critical. And obviously we were in an insane trajectory on the energy front. A guy named Amory Lovins wrote a very important essay in Foreign Affairs, which was an unusual place for it to show up, called The Road Not Taken, which was a kind of an organizing document. And he was quite important and critical. Anyway, I led that. I wrote a few papers on that subject. And one of our, it happened that a guy named John Sawhill, who was the first federal energy commissioner, the commissioner of the Federal Energy Agency, which was started in response to these oil crises, came on our Common Cause board. He invited me to join him in a different enterprise because he was going to become the president of New York University. I wasn't sure I wanted to do it, but then it got better because I could become the senior energy fellow at a place called the Aspen Institute, which is a significant gathering place in the United States. Interesting at the time, especially because it combines business people with others. And I'm, you know, I wanted that sort of integration. So suddenly I'm a senior energy fellow at this place. But I have some strong convictions, and John is, Sawhill is president of NYU, but he's chairing this thing at the Aspen Institute. And I get the most incredible experiences you can imagine. I went to London and met with the OPEC Long Range Planning Council, if you can imagine. Oh, goodness. It's funny, you know. Mm. And first it was odd to be a woman there, certainly odd to be young, and absolutely riveting and fascinating. And there, he was quite enlightened, actually, Yamani, and he was in certain ways, and he was, he felt quite strongly that it was important that the OPEC countries invest in Western economies, especially in some sort of, I don't know, open-minded, I thought, kind of ways. Nonetheless, you know, we were still clearly on an energy path that was impossible. And at the Institute, we would have these seminars, two-week seminars. It's unbelievable to me now, in retrospect, that people, business people, could take 2 weeks off to come to Aspen for a, you know, where they actually had to read and work and think and stuff.
Do you think people would have known about climate change at that point? I mean, certainly ExxonMobil. And do you think that it was politicized even back then, or maybe not so much?
Well, the oil companies had a, you know, had a grip on on the conversation, for one thing. So that was one.
It was more about running out in those days, I think, wasn't it, than climate change, the conversation.
That's right. There was an idea that we might run out of oil. Coal was already Peck's bad boy, really. And so there's a lot of talk about nuclear. I remember I had the TVA head with us and, you know, all of that stuff. So conservation was a big issue. And this was kind of a result of wanting to be less vulnerable to OPEC, actually. It, you know, it was a pretty, in some ways, a rather restricted conversation. But at Aspen, we were allowed to get quite philosophical. And that was good, because actually these things need a little bit of that, I think. Anyway, what should happen? But one of my participants was a fellow in the oil business from Alberta, Canada. And he was by far the best participant, by far, most interesting, liveliest. And John Denver was there, I'll never forget, because this is in Colorado and that's where Denver was. And one night we were all singing all night, you know. And this guy, his name is Bob Borden.
I can I know where this is going. Honestly,
we're the only people there who knew the words to every single song. Every single song. So that began a lovely love affair until he died in 2018. But the idea of me, and he was an American, actually. He was a rocket scientist who'd gone to Cornell and then worked for United Aircraft and hated it and went west and ended up as an engineer and then as an entrepreneur, really, in the wilds of Western Canada. He was born in New York, so he became Canadian, but he was very pseudo-Canadian. He was really, you know. But anyway, he was great. And what was wonderful about him was that he really came to understand the terrible pitfalls of the trajectory that we were on as a world. And he was unbelievably entrepreneurial. He didn't like to work for anybody. And he let me develop, I mean, not let me, but he encouraged me to develop a kind of venture portfolio of our own, which we were free to do, that a chunk of which was in looking at alternatives, including a patent that he wrote, actually, for converting. This is very funny to me, because we didn't end up doing it, but he wanted to take, and for island communities, he wanted to take single hull tankers that were now being decommissioned because they were unsafe, of course, and put these corkscrew wind towers on them, desalinate water, extract the hydrogen, put the oxygen back in the water, and send the hydrogen to the island communities to be used in fuel cells and things like that. It was a great idea. So he was all in on this, and I had a marvelous time with a ton of losses, a few wins, but mostly losses. It wasn't about that, I should say, by the way. This was not, you know, vulture capitalism kind of looking around for the right thing. It was had much more to do with finding usually quite young people with interesting ideas and giving them a little boost at the beginning. And learning so much. The other area that I was very interested in was health and medicine, and protein therapeutics was the area that I focused on. Anyway, while all this is going on, I'm still interested in the brain. I'm trying to get back to the Neurosciences Institute. And I used to go through, when I was in New York, which was all the time, and I lived there for a long time. I would often on my way home, go to the Cornell University Medical School bookstore. You know, and I was a big fan of Darwin's, of course, as was my husband. We were big, and we went to the Galapagos, and, you know, it was as if you had Darwin at your shoulder. Anyway, one day I was going through the bookstore, and they were unpacking, I can see it today, a carton of books, blue cover, and the title of the book was Neural Darwinism. I thought, this is it. This must be it. So I bought the book. It took me 4 months at least to read it. I had really no biology training of any significant kind, but it evoked in me some real questions. And it was written by a guy named Gerald Edelman, who had won the Nobel Prize when he was very young, about 43, for his work in immunology. And excuse me, I'm just going to turn that off. And that's a whole interesting another story. But anyway, I don't know what possessed me, but I wrote him a letter with some questions that had occurred to me, and he wrote me back. And it was lovely. And I wrote him back again, and he wrote me back again. And I wrote him again. And then he said, I noticed from your address that you're 3 blocks away. Why don't you just come down to the lab? So I did.
Oh, what a great story.
I was terrified, of course. Back said, what the hell? You know, this is all fine in writing. But anyway, I went down. And, you know, it was a coup de foudre. I mean, it was just great. And he was profoundly interested in. He was a musician, by the way, an excellent violinist. And I think that mattered, really did. So he's deeply interested in what, you know,
it
what
changes your brain. It makes it.
How do we imagine?
Builds it differently.
And he had some really good ideas about it. And the ideas had a lot to do with another iteration of some of the basics of evolution. The need for a ton of variation, which we have. Our neurons are unbelievably variable. A means of selection, which we also have in the brain, which isn't, it has to do with strengthening the synaptic relationships among neuron groups. And then a means of amplification, the way you would in selection, which has to do with, that's really, I skipped a stage really. The selection bit is the neurons being excited and the strengthening between the neurons, but then what you have is these neuronal groups that get established around which real human capacity happens. At least that was the idea, we thought. Anyway, I spent quite a lot of time there knowing not a thing. They were working mostly theoretically at that time, not so much in the lab. In a wet lab. And at some point and I also was extremely interested in psychology, never mind. But anyway, I told him that I thought that this was going to get a much faster reception among social sort of psych people than it was among molecular biologists, which is, you know, another example of profound reductionism. I mean, it's really unbelievable. And you just are not going to understand these wonderful emergent properties of living things by reducing them to, I don't think. Which is the interstices and the, you know, all that. So he said, okay, prove, you know, okay, great. Let's, he liked to have meetings of, as he used to say, 8 people around the table with no slides. That was his idea of the perfect meeting. So he invited me to organize some of these meetings, and I was able to invite psychoanalysts and social anthropologists and all kinds of people to begin testing out some of these ideas. Well, that began an incredibly long and wonderful relationship. I joined his board eventually, and then we moved the whole place from the Rockefeller University, which is where it was at the time, out to San Diego, built a beautiful campus there of three buildings, including a chamber music hall, because they didn't have one in San Diego, and we thought it was very important to have the arts part of this whole enterprise. Some wet labs where we did some very interesting stuff, and then a theoretical lab, which had the, to be, you know, we had the kind of paradox of having to use, say, to prove that the human brain was nothing like a computer, we actually needed supercomputers to model the brain, but that's the way that was.
Yeah. What, so what are your thoughts? I'm digressing a little bit now, but we've just had, you know, Chat GPT come on the scene. And a couple of years ago, we had AlphaGo, the first computer to obviously win a game of Go against a human being, which my partner is fairly interested in and keeps up with all of that. Do you think, obviously, the human brain computer metaphor has had a bit of a resurgence lately?
Well, I think, honestly, that what we're about, I think we're going to see, not that exactly, I think we're going to see the extension of human agency or human capacity. If we do it right, it'll free us up to actually have, you know, the imaginative ideas. But it's a worry. It's a worry because it's easy to substitute one for the other. And, you know, we've seen that before. But I don't know. That's something I think we need to watch very carefully. In the meantime, I want to be sure that these instruments, that we infect these instruments with MMT ideas.
Yeah. I mean, what I was thinking about while you were talking about it was that... of course, our thinking is all done within our brain and it's embodied, and there are parallels to that where our economy is embodied within our social system, which is embodied within our natural environment. And it takes you back to neoclassical economics, which really misses both of those things. If we're talking about human beings, they're not really interested in how we make decisions or to develop feelings of well-being, so they dismiss both psychology and
it's worse than that. It's not that they're not even interested, they actually don't want that part of it. They want to sterilize the whole process. No human judgment, no human imagination, no differences. The idea is to, this is unbelievably worrying, and that may take us to the framing conversation a little bit, because Gabby, you've heard me on this before, I know, but there is, to me, a confusion between messaging, a necessary relationship, but a confusion between framing and messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. I
think for people who are, especially for activists who feel the need in an almost daily way to be persuasive, I think the messaging piece is very, very important to them. I personally, though, feel that one of the powers of classical conventional orthodox economics is the power of the metaphor that's organized it, or the set of metaphors that have organized it. And I think we don't have that yet. We don't have the equivalent of the sort of, lots of them come to mind, but the idea of equilibrium, the idea of self-regulation, all of that stuff, it makes people feel good. In fact, some people are turned on by it almost, or they, you know, they really love this. And
I've had students say to me that they're not interested in whether something's realistic or not. They just think it's beautiful.
The beauty of it, they think.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of, especially men who have gone into economics, whom I know, young men, I know that some of the appeal is because it orders something and that they think is lovely and great. The problem is, of course, that living things and dynamic things can only exist if they're, you know, at the edge of chaos, actually, at the edge, yes, of, they cannot be reduced to this sort of homeostatic or equilibrium state until they die. But I get the seduction. And of course, then it does strip away all kinds of human judgment, values, all that stuff. We know about that. So I've been
struggling. It's kind of that a group of people or people together can kind of transcend those bits that make individuals, that give us our differences, give us our different viewpoints, our different preferences. Like, you're kind of lumping everybody into one thing, and that takes away the difficult bits and the ugliness of it.
Yes, I think that's part of it. I also think that the aggregating thing is one piece of it, but in a way some people want to strip out everything that they want. Let's just stay with the economy as we know it, sort of market fundamentalism notion. It's supposed to not have any politics involved, ideally. No interventions of any kind that are exogenous. We know all of that. And then it denies these very critical realities that, you know, we've been talking about for the last many months. But for me, the three big things, I've had a lot. I'm now talking, of course, as we all are, all your students are, to everybody who comes across our way. So it doesn't matter if it's a plumber, I was talking to my doctor or a doctor surgeon the other day. I was talking to, in fact, yesterday I was talking to our new state treasurer in Vermont, who's calling me about something else. We had an incredible conversation about this, and he caught on immediately. But I'm experimenting with different ways of putting it. But the first big thing is, and it goes, Stephen, exactly in the sequence that you've been teaching us, but the first really big thing is what money is and where it comes from. And I'm making some headway by, what is the so-called Australian debt, $860 billion or something, I don't know, something like that.
Oh, it's rising all the time, so more than that now, but not much more.
But whatever it is, it isn't, of course, a debt. But most people can get a grasp right away, if you say it this way, that since 19, I don't know, when did you get your current, 1910 or whenever you got your own currency, whenever it was, I don't know.
I think it was 1913, and we started calling it the dollar in 1966.
Okay. Anyway, all of the money in the Australian economy, and certainly all the money in the United States economy, obviously, has been spent into the economy by our governments. That's the only place it can come from. And that's, from some people, quite startling idea, although common
certainly
sense.
The currency,
currency. People are
different ways of defining money, but
indeed, and we do eventually get to credit and some other things, but for the moment, this is just to get their attention, really. And that the budget, you know, there's a deficit clock in Times Square that's ostensibly shows us each how much we owe in some crazy way. But the next thing that's easy to explain is that when the government spends money, it spends money into the economy, and when it taxes, it takes money out of the economy. That's all. And
common sense.
Common sense. And
if you want the world to use the US dollar, you have to supply lots of US dollars for the world to use.
Gotta do it. Yeah. Gotta do it. That's right. But in our language, really, if you can get money and godly, and Minsky, if you can get those three ideas in the conversation, you've gone a long way to sort of beginning to enable people to think a little bit for themselves, which is really what you need to do here, I think. But
on the other side, we're trying to add a bit of Herman Daly to that.
Well, yes, we need Herman Daly. So that's right. So, you know, what I didn't say really was that one of the great lucky things that happened to me was when I first began learning about the economy at all in college, we were really talking about what is an economy for? Mm. And even then, it was very clear that to use your wonderful phrase, that was really to generate sustainable prosperity, by which we meant that if it doesn't supply all people in the world with necessities that are required for an ordinary and healthy and creative life, and number one, and number two, it fails if it doesn't do that using the resources of our Earth in ways that are, we didn't know all the words then, we didn't know planetary boundaries and stuff like that, but that isn't regenerative, and in a way that doesn't learn from what nature does herself, understand those principles a little bit better and build them into our own way of doing things. Those are two just very evident failures of the system that have driven all of this driven us from the beginning. It was great to be able to ask those questions because we're dealing with exactly the same thing now, except I think on the poverty, we understand the climate side. We know that we're in incredibly terrible trouble there. Mm-hmm. And I think we all agree that it's a decade or maybe a little bit more, but we don't have any time at all to do this. Mm-hmm. On the inequality side and poverty side, it cannot be that the 26 richest people, it is, but it shouldn't be, cannot be sustained that the 26 richest people on the planet have as much wealth as 45% of the rest of the people.
Yeah, of course not.
Mm. It's just appalling. Yeah. And so that's the big picture for sure, and the big failure. So what I should say about that is I think two things about that. Mm. One is that we don't have, as Kate Raworth would call it, we haven't designed a system for distribution, which is not a bad. These are design failures, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, because that's the human economy is the economy is a human creation. It's not weather. It's not an act of nature. It's not.
And then we're coming back to millennia a bit.
They wouldn't exactly so. that's also right. But but I also think on the inequity side, I do think that's why democracies are failing.
Yeah,
I think that's at the heart of it. And I think the appeal of strong men and fascist regimes, all of that
it's all very predictable, really, isn't it?
I think so. And so a lot is at stake, the planet is at risk. And so I think there are democratic forms of government if we don't attend to these things together.
Which brings us right back to framing, because when you think, okay, so what are we going to do about it?
Well, it was through my neuroscience work, actually, that I was introduced to the work of George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. In the thinking about metaphor is fundamental to the way we actually think and know the world and ourselves in it. Mark Johnson particularly, he's a philosopher, so he's not as politically engaged as Lakoff is. They feel very strongly, and we don't have time for this really, but the idea is that most of the way that we know the world, actually, we initially are elaborations of our bodily experiences in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is for another conversation probably, but I've been thinking a lot about that and what the appeal of equilibrium is and what the alternative in our world, in the world that we all want to build, might be. And it's very provisional in my mind at the moment, but it's about balance, I think. Mm. And the physical experience of balance, actually, which is an ongoing, ever-present thing. And if we could begin to have the idea that the role of the polity vis-a-vis the economy is actually to maintain balances, and it's always going to be a little out of balance, so it's always going to need some interventions and some work. It's not very sexy, and it's not very, I'm still thinking about it. But for example, I was thinking of the donut, Robert's donut, and how you would think about these things there. Certainly in terms of the inside of the donut, we really need to make a measurable commitment to ensure vastly more equitable distributions of life's essentials. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a is a, I'm not going to get into the growth conversation right now, because I think that is one place. But anyway, that needs obviously a rebalancing. Yeah. There's a continuous rebalancing of economic forces. We need a toolkit of political economic mechanisms that are designed to adjust what's inevitably out of whack.
Yeah.
The problem is that we don't have the alacrity in our political structures to do the fiscal part of that. And we're seeing this revolting and infuriating monetary approach to forcing people who want to have jobs to be unemployed in order to manage. Yeah. I really want to shoot everybody who shouldn't say that, but really, it's so maddening.
Yeah.
Nonetheless,
and we talked quite a lot about that with Nathan in the last episode.
You're right.
So if you're listening and you missed that, check out episode 2. Yeah.
Anyway, I think that I think tools we need, some automatic stabilizers or whatever we want to call them, but things that kick in that don't require legislative action or some sort of that kind of thing. And I don't know what those are, but I'd like to be thinking about inventing them. Mm. And then in terms of the biosphere, what I've been thinking about there lately is that we're going to have to do things that are global as well as local. I mean, I don't know if we could, if we could ever have a global, grid, electrical grid or not, or something like that, but.
We certainly have the technology.
Yeah, well, maybe, but we certainly could, the grid part we could do, what we really don't have are the political institutions that could possibly oversee something like that.
Yeah.
Which takes me to my one nagging thing, and then I probably should let you guys go, but in our conversations, I've been a bit of a defender of Europe. And because most people understandably are feeling that the European Union was a big mistake, primarily because of the loss of currency autonomy. Mm-hmm. And I come at it from a slightly, I come at it from the historical political point of view, feeling that really, if you've had two world wars in this place in a matter of decades, the coming together as a region was really pretty critical. Obviously, the step that they haven't taken is some sort of fiscal integration. But I do think it raises in general a kind of other question, which is the relationship in the United States of states to the federal government. I mean, we've seen this awful pawning off or fobbing off to the states of things that the federal government should be paying for and should be supporting. I think it's very good to have them enacted and taken up by states and communities and towns and localities. But the idea that they should all be paid for by state income taxes and property taxes, including public education in this country, is really wrong. So two things. One is, I think we have a chance here to, if we could get our ideas about federal financing right, we could change the relationship between regions and the currency sovereign. But also, I am worried about the rest of the world that isn't probably never going to have monetary sovereignty, and there will be plenty. And what do we do about them? And how do we empower them in the ways that? And what is the responsibility for those of us who are the rest of the world in terms of financing the things that the transformation that has to happen? This is why I don't get much sleep at night. It's all your fault.
Fidel's working on that, but yes.
Yeah, I was going to say our great colleague and supporter, Fidel Kaboo.
Very much looking forward to getting
to know him. We had better wrap it up, otherwise when we go in the schedules of KRTD, they won't be able to fit it in.
Well, yes. Yeah. But some final thoughts about framing and politics and I want to just go back to what you said about 26 people having the same amount of wealth as the bottom 50% of the population, and how we have kind of really just let this happen without really kicking up much of a fuss about it. I mean, individuals have notably accepted. Lots of us have been fighting for workers' rights and climate justice and all of those really important fights. But as a global community, we have let the situation get to this point, and we're going to have to walk back from that. And we have to have the language to bring people on that journey so that we don't find ourselves in the situation where everybody just sort of thinks of themselves as a temporarily inconvenienced millionaire. So why should, you know, right. why should other right. people get what I didn't get? Do you know what I mean? So that's what keeps me up at night.
All of us, I think, Gabby. I think it's going to be, I don't think we're going to be in the next 2 minutes.
We're not going to undo the 26 people, you know.
No.
They will eventually leave the earth. And and I don't know what will happen. I mean, there'll be more. But I think what it is actually is I know that Phil Lawn's been working on this, but we need a better understanding of what it means to thrive. Yeah. And it sounds so wishy-washy, but I do think that's the key. I'm afraid that it can't happen if we don't figure out another way besides pricing things. I mean, this is one of the things that worries me, by the way, about carbon taxes and stuff like that. You know, I'm a little bit worried actually about using that mechanism for something that we actually should abolish. I mean, there should be yeah. rules, regulations.
Yeah. yeah.
And the idea of pricing it and enabling some people to use stuff that they shouldn't and waste things that they shouldn't and so forth
you need an absolute quantitative limit.
I agree. I agree.
You then do need some way of deciding how to use up that quantitative limit. And one option, if we had a much more even distribution of the ability to pay for things, one option when you've got a quantitative limit is to then have a trading system. It's not the only option, but I think people that suggest cap and trade systems, at least if they're coming from it from an ecological economics perspective, that is sort of the second step. The first step is you have to have a more equitable distribution of income and wealth first.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And then I'm a little bit more bullish than most on, I don't think technology is going to solve things, but I do think that technology has allowed us sometimes to leapfrog steps. Mm. So that in Africa, for example, I mean, where I've spent a little bit of time, there's, you know, you never see telephone poles. Because they didn't do that part. They skipped right to cellular telephones, you know. So there may be some way of some stuff that we can do that I think.
Microgrids and that sort of thing.
Something.
Technology has been enormously important. Again, I think the message that you get from ecological economics, though, is that just shifts the boundary of what's sustainable. It doesn't eliminate. There will always be a limit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's good. We need to know what those are.
Doesn't mean it can't be shifted potentially by changes in the sorts of things that we produce and consume and the way we do it and the technology we use. There will always be an ecological impact.
I think that if part of what we need to do, though, one of the things that some technologies might help with is, I'm thinking, for example, of storing renewable energy, for instance. You know, right now we're thinking about batteries and using rare metals and all of that stuff. And I think I've probably said this in front of you, Gabby, I'm not sure, but I keep asking myself, what would Leonardo do? You know, he wouldn't do all that. He'd be thinking
move it around.
Gravity.
Shift it to where it is, where it's needed.
About lifting things up and then dropping them down when you need them, like, you know.
Yeah, we have one of those in South Australia.
A dam.
What are they called? Hydro battery.
Well,
yeah,
you know, a dam is really like a battery. I mean, putting aside the management of the waterway and all that, but so things like that. But I do think that one thing that a little bit of work on the technology front could do for us is to make people a little more relaxed about what they think they're going to give up or lose or something like that. We need a little bit of hope and possibility and air in this, because boy, talk to anybody who's under 25 and they're very concerned and tight about it. And and I want them to be more imaginative, and I mean, I want the fight, but I also would like them to think that.
Which is one of the reasons we started doing this in the first place, because it all goes back, or at least the Modern Money Lab before we thought about doing the degree, goes back to Gabby and I going on a young person's climate march, or I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and hearing all the anguish and anger and not hearing any solutions or anything, even which was a step on the way to a solution, and thinking, well, what can we do about this? We can bring together some people and we can ask them to think, and maybe in time we could have some useful research, or we can be out there in the media, we can be persuading politicians, which we've done a little bit, but not enough. Who knows what the impact will be. But thank you so much, Susan, for all the things you do and your participation. And we do have some younger people also. I mean, they're not all of my generation.
Not all old people.
And it's great. Well, it's great that there's such a mix of experiences and connections. It actually makes it a great pleasure to be involved in. And it's a tremendous privilege for us to have participant on the course like you, Susan. We really appreciate it. I was just thinking while you were talking about framing there that an economist who we both know has been in touch with me about concerns about what title she should choose for her new book, and I think she should talk to you, Susan, rather than to me.
I'd be honored. Yes, that's good. I can't wait.
I was getting some ideas just listening to you. Oh, good. Okay. 5 minutes
that's great. They're all yours, for sure. Well, let me just say that it's an unbelievable, not just lifeline, but it's just totally energized me in my life at this moment to be able to join you in this. It's just you'll never know what a privilege it is, unless you speak to my friends who are probably ready to kill you, but no, they're not.
Thanks very much.
Love it. Everybody's keen, and I've got another 20 years, I figure, at this, and that's pretty good.
Every moment of this has been fascinating today. This is the first time we've ever done an hour's podcast. We do have an hour slot
episode
available to us, so we
wasn't even
the entire slot, and it's been marvelous.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for inviting me into the course. And I look forward to many years of collaboration. I really do.
Wonderful. Thanks. And we might even see you in person one day. That would be brilliant.
Thinking about next year.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. I have to swim though, right? I can't take a plane.
Oh, you could take a solar powered yacht, perhaps.
Oh, there we are. We're developing an electric airplane actually here up in Vermont.
Amazing. Yeah.
Don't be in the first test flight. Just take
care. I've got someone else doing that. Thank you. All right.
Yeah, it's a fraud.
Thank you.
But it's been so great to talk to you, Susan. And yes, thank you for being part of this podcast, and thank you for being on our course. We're really glad that first email from you. I really loved the way you introduced yourself, and I thought, yes, this person is going to be brilliant.
Thank you. There
you are. So all right, we'll say goodbye and we'll play a tiny little bit of our outro music. And I just wanted to mention that the music that you're hearing in the introduction and also just in the next couple of seconds is by my partner Alexander Hannes, and he is a pianist. You can find him online at www.hanysz.com, and he has given us permission to use his clips. So
lovely. Thank you
Alex, for that. And we'll see you next time on Modern Money Donuts.
Lovely.
Thank you, Susan.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.